Welcome, and thank you for joining us for the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. On this week's episode, NAHU's Marcy Buckner and Chris Hartman will discuss the final rule issued by CMS resuming the risk adjustment program. In addition, they will detail NAHU's August recess talking points that you can use in your in-district meetings this summer. Just a reminder before we begin, please take a moment to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and to rate us. The podcast is posted every Friday on these channels ahead of being distributed through the Washington Update, giving you a head start on your weekly healthcare happy hour. The big whoop for this week's Washington Update podcast is CMS issuing a final rule resuming risk adjustment payments to insurance companies with plans on the individual market. This comes on the heels of CMS halting payments for 2017 several weeks ago, citing a federal judge's ruling in a New Mexico lawsuit earlier this year. With the risk adjustment program back on, what impact will it have on stabilizing both the individual and small group markets for the coming year? And is there still a possibility that the risk adjustment program is halted in the future?
So going back to one of the podcasts we had a couple of weeks ago talking about the challenge to the risk adjustment payments, there are two different court decisions. The Massachusetts decision saying that the way that the risk adjustment payments were being calculated and the methodology of making these budget neutral was appropriate. And then we had the New Mexico case coming out in February saying that the way that the methodology was calculated based on the state premiums and then making sure that the program was budget neutral was not appropriate. And so as a result of that New Mexico ruling, the administration asked, and there is still a pending request for New Mexico federal court to revisit their ruling. But in the meantime, the administration took action pretty quickly and came out with this final rule to really explain why they are using the state premium methodology when they're looking at the risk adjustment payments, and specifically explaining why the program needs to be budget neutral. That was the big challenge in what was happening in the New Mexico court case. And normally when we have rules, we have a proposed rule, there's a comment period, we submit comments, and then there's a final rule. Here, they came out with this final rule without doing a proposed rule first because they're not changing the actual makeup of how the risk adjustment payments are being calculated. And HHS felt like they had already received comments about that calculation from 2014 on, every year that they published the calculation for that year. And so they had received comments on that piece. And really what this final rule is doing is explaining why it's important that risk adjustment payments be budget neutral. So they're not really changing anything. They're just taking the time to go back and explain this one item from the rule to make sure that they can now trigger those payments, which are going to start in August of 2018. So it was really important that they go ahead and take action now so the 2017 risk adjustment payments can begin for 2018.
Marcy, how do you think this will help actually stabilize the individual and small group insurance markets?
I think that this will have a really big impact actually on 2019 rates, not so much 2018 rates. So when these announcements were coming out and the announcement came out from the administration that they were going to halt the payments because of these court cases, the 2018 premiums had pretty much already been filed across the states. They're still being finalized now in many states, but carriers had already put together what they were planning on having for 2018. It was really the 2019 premiums that were at risk, where we could possibly have seen carriers decide to rate up in 2019 based on the uncertainty of whether they would have risk adjustment payments for 2017, 2018, and beyond. Although we're not seeing the immediate effect of this, we have prevented seeing an increase in premiums for 2019, which I think is a good stabilizing effort here.
Is there any possibility that these payments will be stopped again this year?
Not for this year, specifically because of this final rule. And the final rule really talks about this year. Then they're going to come out for 2018 and 19 and do how they have done in the past every year, coming out with their calculation. And I think that the administration has really learned their lesson here on what needs to be included when they make those announcements and those proposals. And again, here, they're going to make sure that they focus on why these need to be budget neutral payments, meaning the payments going to the government are the same in amount that are going back out to the carriers who have taken on these larger risks in the folks that they're insuring. And the reason why it's important for this to be balanced goes back to your stabilization question. If there is uncertainty in how much is going to be taken up from carriers and then redistributed, it is very hard for carriers to really be able to count on exactly how much they could get back in risk adjustment payments from the government, creating more uncertainty, which could lead to higher premiums. So here, making sure that this is a budget neutral effect allows carriers to have more accountability and a better expectation of exactly what type of payments they're going to be receiving from the government so they can plan accordingly with their rates in the coming years. And it takes a little bit of that uncertainty out of the market for this to be a budget neutral program.
August recess for the House is just around the corner. A reminder to please log in any in-district meetings on our website so we may provide you with customized talking points by request. NAHU has developed some general talking points for your recess meetings. They are broken down into three main categories: market stabilizers, taxes and other repeals, and Medicare. What are the important takeaways from these talking points, and what tips should we keep in mind when meeting with our legislators?
And so we included our August talking points in last week's Washington Update, and we will have a link to them again along with this podcast in this week's Washington Update. So if you are not listening while you're driving and you want to follow along at home to the August recess talking points, please do. They are not only on the Washington Update, but they're also on our website. If you go to Advocacy and then Legislative Issues, the August talking points are right there at the top. And of course, before we go into any of the breakdowns of the different market stabilizers that we're focusing on, we do want to make sure that we focus on one of the most important things to talk about when you're meeting with your member of Congress, and that's the importance of educating them on the role of the broker.
Yeah, I think it's really important for people to understand that the average agent does not work for an insurance carrier, that you work with individuals, small businesses, large businesses, seniors on Medicare Advantage, and you really try to help them find the right plan, be it a Blues plan, an Aetna plan, a Cigna plan, or maybe a larger business who wants to self-insure. And you look at things of like, what's the doctor network? What's the hospital network? If it's a senior, what's prescription drugs are they on? And then you really help them find that right plan, figuring out how much they would be paying. These things could vary. You know, you don't want to necessarily want the cheapest plan if it has a very high deductible. And then once that they're in that plan, you guys keep up that relationship going. I think people think that it's sort of a sales job that comes to an end, but you keep working with them to make sure the carrier actually provided what they said they would provide. You know, if you're an employer and you have one of your employees get cancer, you really want to make sure the carrier's providing the chemo that they said they would provide. And so you guys stay on top of the insurance carrier to make sure that those benefits are provided to people who are trying to stay healthy or become healthy. And finally, when that year's up, you guys do a great job of looking at what the market looks like for the new year. Do we need to be switching plans? Do we need to be changing that deductible? What are the rates going to be looking like? Unfortunately, the rates do keep going up. And so that is all the more reason why you need to use a broker to find the cheapest rates available in that community. So I think that role of the agent is something that is not necessarily intuitive for that member of Congress or for that staffer who works for that member of Congress, because it's not something they deal with in a day in and day out basis. So explaining that role is very important.
So what market stabilizers are we focusing on for the individual employer markets?
On the individual market side, we are requesting Congress to act to continue funding for the cost-sharing reduction payments. This is something that was halted in the fall of 2017, and because of that, we saw rates skyrocketing for 2018. We saw a lot of plans going through and doing what we call silver loading and increasing the costs of silver plans, because that is the plan that subsidies are based off of. And so even though the cost sharing reduction payments weren't going to the carriers, the consumers were still seeing those lower co-payments that go along with the cost sharing reduction payments. And the carriers were silver loading so that these premiums were going up as consumers' income was possibly being sustained, but because of the premiums increasing, the consumers are now getting higher subsidies in return. And so this is actually costing more than not funding the cost-sharing reduction payment. We have an entire podcast on the cost-sharing reduction payment issue and what has happened since the announcement to halt that, so I don't want to continue too much into that. But we do think that this would be a major market stabilizer if we were able to get Congress to take action and finalize cost-sharing reduction payments into the future. Another piece that would be very important on the individual market is to allow states to be eligible for reinsurance funding. We suggest that this should be done through hybrid high-risk pools that would not just issue coverage, but would be available as a reinsurance mechanism to ensure risk above certain levels for high-risk individuals. We suggest possibly for those that enrolled after a certain amount of days. There's a few different ways that this could be put into place, but right now we're hearing a lot about reinsurance programs, the importance of this. It's different than the risk adjustment payments that we talked about at the top of the podcast. This is a completely different system, but it is part of those three R's that was part of the ACA that hasn't, and this piece has not been sustained. We have a lot of states that have been taking up waivers to be able to put a reinsurance market in place within their borders, and it's been really successful for them so far, and we've seen them dropping their premiums.
States like Minnesota and Alaska, who did this on their own by putting in reinsurance pools, really have actually had decreases in rates, and to see an actual decrease, not just reducing an increase, but a decrease, is quite amazing. I think what we need here is the federal government to provide resources for this. States like Minnesota were able to do this because of some funds and surpluses that were available, but as we all know, most states don't have funds and surpluses available. So having a dedicated fund from the federal government going out to the states to provide reinsurance, I think would motivate more states to do this.
And I think this is where we say, you know, the states are always test pool for democracy and for what can happen on a federal level. And these states have really shown how to do this on a reinsurance level. And so we're working on the federal level to help provide funds for states to be able to do this. And one of the avenues that they could apply to be able to do this is through 1332 waivers, those state innovation waivers. And with this, we're asking for more flexibility from the federal government for states to apply for these. There have been some pieces that have put in place to make it easier for states to apply for 1332 waivers. Currently, governors and or insurance commissioners can apply now for these on their own without having to go through the state legislature to approve it. However, there are still some issues on the federal side, some red tape and timing that makes it a very lengthy process to get these approved. Many times states apply for these 1332 waivers, and by the time they get any response from the federal government, the timing for which the state had planned to implement these programs has already passed, and they're no longer available to do this.
Oklahoma and others actually just withdraw their 1332 waiver because they didn't get any response from the federal government. And we know insurance carriers need to start planning several months out for their next year's rates, and so it's not the sort of thing that you can approve on December 31st and then have it ready for the next year.
And I think this is a great one to talk about when your members of Congress are back in district, because it is a state-federal partnership on how to apply for these waivers and then get them approved on the federal level. And it's something that members of Congress can take action on to really ease some of what's happening in their district and in their states.
Our talking points also point to increased flexibility for HSAs. With that being said, the House has passed some HSA-related bills at the end of this week. Can you provide a quick refresher on the major provisions in these pieces of legislation, as well as the likelihood that these bills are approved in the Senate?
So the House has passed some HSA legislation this week. It's not quite as robust as we have been advocating for. There's also several different provisions. I think what we at NHU would find most useful is to expand what you can do with your HSA. For those who have HSAs now, there are many things that people think you should be able to do with your HSAs that you can't. For example, use telemedicine for direct primary care, for even keeping your child onto your plan up to age 26, but you can't use your HSA for them up to age 26.
You can until age 24, but only if they're a student.
So what we really need to do is expand what you can do with that HSA and really align it to something that's more logical to the way people think. And these HSA rules are over a decade old. And so when you're advocating with your member of Congress is to really advocate of expanding what you can do with that HSA. And that is something that gets bipartisan interest. I think there are some who are more interested in expanding the caps on HSAs. That does not have the bipartisan appeal. We're really concerned about people who already have an HSA today but aren't able to use it for their health care and for their actual needs out there. And so there are a number of pieces of legislation, but I think it's most important to explain to your member of Congress that HSAs aren't able to do what most people consider to be logical things, like maybe you're a larger employer that has an on-site health clinic. Well, you can't go into that on-site health clinic and use your HSA. That just is illogical to the average employee out there. And so being able to, if you have a chronic condition and you need to take medication for that chronic condition, managing any chronic condition, unfortunately right now you can't use your HSA for it. That's completely illogical for the average person who has an HSA who thinks it's supposed to help with their health insurance. And so I think that's what would really advocate with a member of Congress that this needs to be updated. And it has more bipartisan appeal than just the idea of being able to put more money into your HSA, which some feel is just a tax shelter for those making lots of money.
And I know we've been really excited about the fact that the House has taken this up. We've talked about it on a few podcasts in the past, just about how this has risen in importance, especially on the House side. So, Chris, what are your thoughts about the Senate possibly taking this up, either while they're stuck here around in August, because remember, they're taking a shortened August recess on the Senate side, or possibly taking it up after Labor Day?
So I don't see the Senate taking up the bills that were passed by the House of Representatives, but I do think there's an opportunity after the summer to start fresh on some of these issues. The Senate possibly taking up their own plans for HSAs. Chairman Hatch has interest in reforming the HSAs. We very much want to do this on a bipartisan basis. Early versions of an HSA reform bill in the House of Representatives were very bipartisan, with some very conservative and several very liberal Democrats all on board with it. You still need to build that same sort of relationship on the Senate side because of that requirement for 60 votes in. And so I think sticking to what you can do with your HSA and what isn't currently allowed on HSA would mean that we're likely to see either in the fall or after the election some bill expanding HSAs. Probably not what was passed this week in the House, though, which turned into a more partisan environment. And unfortunately, the bill was salted with some poison pills that made members uncomfortable voting for it.
And what about employer market stabilization?
One of the pieces that we have always been very passionate about is the preservation of the employer tax exclusion. This is the ability for employees to deduct from their income the funds that employers are providing towards their health insurance. It also allows employers to show a reduction in salary when they're reporting on their FICA taxes. So it is a great tax benefit both to employees and employers. And the theory here is that there are some that feel like if we are able to cap or remove this tax provision, so being able to either tax part of this money or all of it, would bring in a lot to the coffers on the federal government side. However, we see this as possibly being the largest tax increase on middle-class Americans that we've seen in quite some time, especially when we think about the fact that over 177 million Americans receive their health insurance from their employers. So this is something that we do ask that you bring up with your members of Congress. It's very important to make sure that we preserve this. I know we talk oftentimes that this is usually something that comes up on the chopping block if they're looking for some type of pay for, some way to bring in money to the federal government, but we really don't think that it should be done so at the expense of the American employee consumers and the employers. It really hurt both of those entities. And we have some really great infographics on this if you need help explaining it when you're doing your meetings with your members of Congress that we'd be happy to share with you.
Yeah, I think it's important to remind members of Congress that it's this tax exclusion that really makes it financially viable for an employer to offer health insurance. And this is really how, if this is either capped or goes away, this is when employers start truly bailing from the health insurance market completely and dumping people into an individual market that, as we know, is unstable and has even higher rates. In the employer-based market, while it's gone up a little bit, has not gone up anything like the individual market. And why would we want to take people from a stable employer-based market and dump them into somewhere that's been unstable for the last several years?
And another issue that we're working on the employer side is, of course, employer reporting. We have heard you guys on how difficult this is, how hard it is to be in compliance, the time and money that you all are spending to be able to even attempt to comply with the employer reporting requirements. We are working on legislation that would offer a prospective reporting system so that you would be reporting at the beginning of the year of those that you are expecting to offer coverage to, and then kind of reconciling throughout the year if things have changed or adjusted. But we think that this would be a much easier process for employers as well as for the government who's trying to track these. I think we've all seen the flubs that have happened with the 226J letters for 2015 employer reporting penalties, and we know that the government itself is having trouble on their end for employer reporting, perhaps more so or equal to the trouble that employers are having trying to be in compliance. And so this is our way to work with Congress to try to alleviate some of those burdens that you all are feeling with employer reporting.
Yeah, a prospective employer reporting system, I think, would be simpler for employers, and it would also be good for employees, because right now employees go into healthcare.gov. They might shop around and look at other plans available, but they don't realize they're not eligible for that tax credit because they're getting health insurance from their employer. And so they end up buying a plan online, and later the IRS could come after them for tens of thousands of dollars that they owe from a tax credit that they were not eligible for because they are eligible for health care from their employer. This is all information that would be much more useful to have online ahead of time than afterwards. I really think this is an important bill to talk to your member of Congress too, because we've gotten word from the House of Representatives that they are very much interested in putting this bill possibly on the floor when we come back in September. So it's more important now than ever to let people know that simplifying the employer reporting system, I think, is good for employers. It keeps them interested in staying in the employer-based healthcare system. It would reduce cost of reporting, which is money they could put back into health insurance, back into an HSA, and good for the employees that they will have information up front to really understand their health insurance cost and not have to hand over their dependent Social Security number to their boss, where I don't think their boss really wants their dependent Social Security numbers either. So I think this is a really great one to talk about. A lot of bipartisan support out there. People just need to understand that detail, because a lot of member Congress obviously don't have to deal with this reporting in their own offices, so they might not understand it. And you employers and brokers out there need to explain it to their members of Congress.
And something on this issue that we've been cautioning about is our anxiety about possibly seeing in the news and on the headlines that folks are going in and getting subsidies and then being hit with these large tax bills because they didn't realize they were being offered employer-sponsored coverage that was deemed affordable for that employee. And this is something that, as much as we have been worried about seeing it in the headlines, it has started in the headlines. I think in California, we saw a number of stories that were like this. And with this prospective reporting system, those types of things are less likely to happen. And it's really a protection for those employees to not end up on the other end with a large tax bill.
Moving on to healthcare-related tax bills, what message would we like members of Congress to hear regarding the repeal of some of the ACA taxes, specifically the Cadillac and HIT taxes?
So when you talk to your member of Congress, I think both the HIT tax and Cadillac tax are very important. We are advocating very hard for the complete repeal of the Cadillac tax. The House Bill H.R. 173 has over 300 co-sponsors to repeal the Cadillac tax. And as we know, it takes 218 votes to pass a bill, so 300, we are well over that number now. So I would encourage them to bring the bill to the floor. The Cadillac tax is something that will have a negative effect on premiums. It is something that all health insurance plans will end up having to pay. They have to pay a 40% tax on these plans. And employers, when they see something as high as 40% tax, an employer does not plan to pay that tax. They avoid it completely. So what you'll see and what you've seen as we get closer to the Cadillac tax coming in place is higher deductibles or smaller benefits. And so neither one are good for employees and consumers. And so we need this tax eliminated now. And I'd encourage your member of Congress to bring this to the floor also in September and get this tax completely off the books. When it comes to the HIT tax, the health insurance tax, this is a tax that is currently in place for this year. It is not in place for the year 2019, and we would like to see that extended out even further delay. And so we can't do this last minute, which is why we need to see a delay of the HIT tax put in place soon. The reason we have the HIT tax in place for this calendar year is we went right up to the very last minute debating a delay of the HIT tax, and it's the sort of thing that gets built into the insurance premium for the year, so you can't go back and undo it retroactively. And so we need this delay now so that when plans start putting together their premiums for 2020, they don't start building it in with that tax. And remember, this is a tax that adds about $500 onto every policy, a few percentage points. And so it's basically just making health insurance more expensive for everyone.
So we did see the House pass a further two-year delay on the HIT tax in H.R. 6311 this week. Do you see this passing out of the Senate with little controversy?
So the bill that the delay of the HIT tax was included in with many other items, several of which were controversial. So it's a little hard to say that the bill that it was put in would be passed directly. What I think is more likely is that in some sort of end-of-the-year omnibus package, getting another year delay of the HIT tax, I think, is something that members of Congress are open to doing. I think as long as it's not packaged with things that upset members of Congress, I think some of the opposition you saw to the bill in the House was not the HIT tax itself, but other things that were put in that overall piece of legislation. So I think getting another year delay is possible, but probably not the bill that came out of the House of Representatives this week. I don't see that particularly passing the Senate, but pushing the overall issue I do think is something that can happen this year.
And then one more piece that we're looking on for taxes and other repeals is, of course, removing the agent and broker commission from the medical loss ratio. As you all know, we've been working on this for quite some time, and the medical loss ratio requires 80% of the premium dollar to go towards medical costs, 20% to go towards administrative costs, or 85-15, depending if you're a small or large employer. And right now, agent commissions are booked into that administrative fund bucket. And we, of course, do not think that you are an administrative cost, and are working on legislation that we create a carve out so that commissions could be paid out before that 80-20 or 85-15 is calculated. And we're working on this for a number of reasons. And it's not just from the commission standpoint, it's also from a standpoint of competition in the marketplace. We have been in talks with several smaller carriers who feel that the medical loss ratio is a barrier for them to enter into the market. Being held to that strict 80% on premium costs or 85%, again, depending on the market, has caused many of these smaller carriers not to be able to afford out of their administrative bucket to be able to pay commissions to agents and brokers to go and be the sales force and the consumer-facing entities out on the streets with consumers. And so it's prevented them from really getting into the market. And something that we know that President Trump, through his executive orders, has been very passionate about is increase in choice and competition in the marketplace with the hopes of decreasing premiums. And we think that if we are able to pass this piece of legislation and create this carve out for agents and brokers, not only could we possibly see commissions rising, but we could also possibly see an increase in carriers in the market, creating more competition and a healthier marketplace overall.
And on to our last category, NHU is always working on something in the Medicare market. What are some of the advocacy efforts we would like members of Congress to hear about during August recess?
So I think it's important to let them know that Medicare is something that also is evolving and that their constituents can also run into problems with if they don't understand all the rules and regulations around Medicare. One of those that we've found that constituents don't understand from Medicare is that COBRA, which is the insurance that you have from your employer when you separate from your employer, COBRA is not counted as credible coverage with Medicare. So what happens is, if you're with your employer and you stay on the employer plan after 65, Medicare is great with that. They will not give you any sort of penalty for not signing up for Medicare Part B. But if you go onto COBRA when you leave your employer, they do not consider that credible coverage, and therefore you will pay a penalty when signing up for Medicare, and penalties for the rest of your life, and that can become very expensive. And I think employees get very confused because COBRA is the same insurance policy that you had when you were with your employer, and there's lots of reasons that you might have stayed on it. For example, you've already paid down your deductible for the year, so why not stay on the plan? Or maybe you have your spouse on your plan, and so you will need to make sure that they have health insurance. Unfortunately, CMS has not been sympathetic to those problems, and so we need to get them to change. And there's a great bill in the House, HR 5104, which will allow these people back into Medicare Part B without paying that penalty.
Another piece we're working on in Medicare is a Medicare Advantage, what we're calling a broker bill. And we are still working on the formal introduction of this with Mike Kelly. And what we're looking at here is to try to soften the rules about scope of appointments and the requirements for agents and brokers, allowing them to be able to follow up sooner and to discuss more options when they're meeting with their clients on Medicare Advantage issues. So right now, agents have to provide the scope of appointment before they're able to meet with their clients. It has to specifically list the things that they are planning on talking about with their clients. And oftentimes when we're looking at Medicare Advantage and other Medicare programs, it's really important for the broker to be able to discuss with the client some other aspects of their lives, where they are financially, what type of health issues they possibly see on the horizon, whether they have long-term care insurance, and this is something to take into account with the type of Medicare Advantage plan they're going into. And right now, with the rules the way they are, they're limited from being able to do this. And so we are working on trying to get this introduced so that we can really make sure that the consumers are protected and able to discuss all of their options with their agent without having to go back and refile the scope of appointments.
Finally, another Medicare issue that a lot of Medicare Advantage brokers and others have dealt with is this issue of observation stays and who pays for inpatient stay in nursing home care facilities. And what's been happening is a lot of clients out there are suddenly getting this surprise bill from a hospital, staying in the hospital for what everybody assumed Medicare was going to be paying for it. And so this is this issue of observation stays. And the fact that a lot of people suddenly get a bill from the hospital for something that Medicare does not cover, that they felt it was very logical to be covered, that it was a skilled nursing facility and therefore should have been covered, comes as a big surprise to people and could be a lot of money for a senior. And what's worst is nobody told them ahead of time that this was going to happen. So HR 1421 and Senate Bill 568 would have all of these count for Medicare and have Medicare cover those costs and not the individual who gets very surprised. And so it's been a big issue for our brokers who work with seniors, who then those seniors come back to the broker and say, what happened? Why do I have all these bills? If I have Medicare Advantage and I have Medicare, why suddenly am I paying all this money for what seemed to me like the same service I was already getting from the hospital to begin with?
And what seemed to be an inpatient stay, but is being coded as observation status by the hospital, either while the patient is there, and it is just confusing because you can imagine how confusing it is when you're staying overnight at a hospital and not realizing whether you're an inpatient or under observation status, or sometimes the hospitals are going back and retroactively coding it differently, and so Medicare is not covering these observation status if it's with this 3-midnight rule, so without being an inpatient. So that's really the confusing part, is making sure that it is very clear to the consumer whether they're an inpatient or they're in observation status, and then making sure that this can't be something that's retroactively changed and billed back to the consumer.
So if you guys could just go over one more time the resources we have available for the August recess.
So if you're making an appointment with your member of Congress, again, make sure you go online and log your appointment or send us an email and let us know who you're meeting with. And we're happy to send you some tailored talking points on these issues specific to who you're meeting with. We also obviously have this podcast going over the different issues, as well as the specific talking points that are on our website. Also, if you go to our website and you go to the Federal Action Center, you can see all of these issues broken down into their own one-pagers where you can learn even more about the different issues on employer reporting and COBRA as creditable coverage and all of the things that we mentioned. And then you'll also see where there is an opportunity, if you haven't done so already, to go through our Operation Shout system and send a message to your member of Congress on these issues.
Finally, it's time for the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour's Toast of the Week. What are we toasting to?
This week, we are toasting to Senators Cassidy, Bennett, Grassley, Carper, Young, and Caskill for hosting a transparency roundtable looking at ways that the Senate can look into legislation or other pieces to work either bicamerally with the House or possibly with the administration to put together pieces to increase transparency and innovation in the health insurance market industry. And this is something that our own Janet Trotwine will be representing us during the roundtable. So we would like to toast to these senators for moving forward and hosting a conversation on this vital issue.
Cheers!
Thank you for joining us on this week's installment of the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. For more information on NAHU's government affairs efforts, or to join as a member of NAHU, visit nahu.org.